Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We're delighted you are here. Thank you very much for coming. And Senator, I must confess, when you said Friday, I thought, oh, what a dangerous time. Nobody does anything at Friday noon, you know, in Washington, D.C. And here, look, we've got a great turnout, which I think is a testament to people's interests in what you're going to share with us today. Thank you very much. Thanks for choosing us. You all know Senator Feingold, having been one of the most active and committed members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and we've all been fortunate for that leadership. We here at CSIS are especially grateful because it was Senator Feingold who said that he wanted to take up the challenge of HIV/AIDS and is the co-chair of our commission with Senator Frist on working on this terrible problem of HIV/AIDS, the pandemic. And really because of your leadership, Senator, the Senate remains really one of the engines in moving this agenda forward for America and, frankly, for the world. And it was because of your personal intervention and your consistent energy that we've been able to get this far. The country's gotten this far, and I personally want to thank you for that. You've not confined your energies or interests strictly to HIV/AIDS, however. You've traveled extensively through Africa, and has because you've been the ranking member on the African subcommittee, and I know it's through that auspices. I know that Steve Morrison has worked with you through the years, and we've had a chance to get to know you. And you've also been quite active in looking at other parts of the world and taking out to the rest of the world America's interest and commitment in such things as transparency and accountability and rule of law, the very things that, frankly, you also speak pretty boldly on the floor of the Senate about every now and then. So we're delighted that you are here. Senator Feingold indicated that he wanted to take this as an opportunity to speak more broadly on issues not strictly limited to his portfolio with the Africa Subcommittee or even the Foreign Relations Committee. So it's going to be a rich opportunity. Senator, thank you for coming. We're looking forward to hearing you.
Good afternoon, and I do thank you, all of you, for being here after, I'm sure, a hard, busy week to come to this opportunity to share some of my ideas with you. Dr. Hamry, thank you for the kind introduction and for hosting me here today. It's an honor to be with you, and I appreciate your long career of distinguished service and, of course, your very kind words about me and my work. And, of course, that means thanks to Stephen Morrison, too. Steve, it's been a pleasure working with you on the HIV/AIDS Task Force as one of its co-chairs. I appreciate the continued work that you do that pushes us to think strategically about Africa, about HIV/AIDS, and other critical issues. And also my thanks to the staff here at CSIS for the good work that they do day in and day out. As the people at CSIS well know, to strengthen our own security, we have to think well beyond our borders. Today we face a wide range of potential and real threats that are literally, and perhaps more than ever, all over the map. To address those threats and to protect the American people, our country needs a new national security strategy, one that is not focused on Iraq to the exclusion of other more pressing priorities. I'm going to talk today about the most real security challenges we must face and the principles we must adopt if we're going to successfully meet those challenges. But first, I'd like to take you to something that happened a few years ago on one of those spots on the map, because I think it speaks volumes about how complex the challenges that we face really are. North of Mombasa, Kenya, on the Swahili coast, is a small fishing village that was the staging ground for the strikes against the Paradise Hotel and the El Al or Arkia airliner in November 2002. The mortars that the terrorists used in that attack came into Kenya through Mombasa Harbor. And I'm sure many of you are aware of just the nature of that area. It's part of Kenya, but it is a dominantly Islamic population and area. And it's how the terrorists brought these explosives in that is so chilling. One of them posed as a lobster boat fisherman in this little village for months. Now, at this point, my staff are rolling their eyes because here goes the lobster story again. But I think it's instructive. This fisherman got comfortable among the other fishermen. And when the time was right, remember, this is very close to Yemen, to Somalia. It's not far away from these places. When the time was right, he floated the explosives used in the attacks through the harbor. Now, in order for that plan to work, some of those fishermen almost surely must have looked the other way. And when they did, the explosives were delivered, and 12 innocent people were killed. This did great damage to the security view of Kenya and to their tourism industry. And of course, let's not forget, this isn't just some place in the world where a random terrorist attack occurred. This was one of the two places, Nairobi, Kenya, where our embassy was attacked in 1998. What can we learn from this successful terrorist attack? For one thing, we are reminded that the fight against terrorism can't only be about military options. Obviously, we wouldn't use kinetic energy to wipe out an entire community of largely peaceful lobster fishermen. We can't simply use weapons to destroy safe havens or recruiting pools. And while we can aggressively target potential terrorists, we can't base our strategy on the sole assumption that we will catch everyone in time. What we can try to do, in fact, what we must do, is address the conditions that allow a terrorist to work his way into a lobster fishing community. That means thinking about how to get communities around the world to reject terrorism and extremism. We need to give people in countries like Kenya a stake in their own stability. We need people like those fishermen to have a reason not to turn the other way when they are faced with growing extremism in their own communities. How do we do that? We need to address the basis of terrorism itself, the things that help it flourish, because those are the same things that can kill it at its root. In other words, we need a strong, comprehensive national security strategy that actually addresses the complicated, intricate challenges we face in places like Mombasa. Unfortunately, we're failing to adequately address those challenges right now. We're failing in part because of our misguided and burdensome presence in Iraq. We're failing because of Guantanamo, and because of our go-it-alone approach to diplomacy, and because of our failure to hold governments accountable for not abiding by the rule of law. We're failing, in other words, in large part because of what we're not doing throughout the rest of the world. We need a new approach, and we need it now. And we should start by redeploying our troops from Iraq. Our military has performed heroically in Iraq. But as long as 130,000 U.S. troops remain in Iraq indefinitely, that country will remain what we have helped make it, a crucible for the recruitment and development of terrorists determined to fight so-called American occupiers. And as long as we are devoting so many of our resources to Iraq, we will be unable to comprehensively combat the global terrorist networks that threaten us today in so many countries around the world. It is well known and well documented that some of our efforts in Afghanistan are hurt by the diversion of resources to Iraq. But our efforts in many other countries are suffering as well. The cost of the Iraq war has been devastating. Obviously, consider the tragic loss of more than 2,400 American servicemen and servicewomen and the more than 17,800 wounded. Every one of those numbers represents struggle and heartache for so many American families. The price tag for Iraq was at one point feared that it could get as high as $100 billion. Of course, now it's upwards of $320 billion. Our military recruitment problem is growing. Suspicions of American intentions are rampant in Muslim and Arab countries. And Al-Qaeda and its allies are operating in scores of countries around the world. Many of us warned about the dangers of going to war in Iraq. But I'm not interested today in rehashing those arguments because it's becoming increasingly clear to many Americans even those who initially supported the war, that our presence in Iraq is weakening us. It's critical to our wider effort against terrorism to redeploy from Iraq. That's why I filed an amendment to the Emergency Supplemental Appropriations Bill a few weeks ago, requiring the Pentagon to draw up a flexible timeline for redeployment of U.S. troops from Iraq by the end of the year. And we did a great deal to make sure to determine that this, in fact, is a realistic goal in the time frame. Obviously, if it doesn't start happening soon, it's not. But it is not an unrealistic goal from the point of view of the military sources that we have talked to. The President has repeatedly failed to spell out for the American people when we can expect our troops to redeploy from Iraq. He has refused to provide a vision for ending our military mission in Iraq. And as a result, a growing majority of Americans have lost confidence in our purpose, our direction, and our presence in Iraq. I was blocked procedurally from getting a vote on my amendment, but I'll be looking for the next opportunity to offer it again. Because if we want to strengthen our national security, we must return to our true national security mission in the wake of 9/11. And that is defeating the terrorist networks that everybody agrees continue to threaten us. Let me talk now about some of the threats we face by using some examples. In each case, it seems to me that our overwhelming dedication of resources in Iraq tends to distract us or divert us from engaging these situations as comprehensively as we should to protect the American people. I'll start with Indonesia. Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, the fourth largest country in the world from a population point of view, is a critical player in the global fight against Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. The terrorist organization Al-Jamaah Al-Islamiyah, also known as JI, and associated groups in the region pose a serious threat to Indonesia and to the interests of the United States, our allies, and our friends. We all know about the Bali attack, but of course there have been attacks in other places in Indonesia and in Jakarta as well. While our relationship with the Indonesians has never been more important, Indonesia's effectiveness in countering terrorist networks and other emerging threats hinges on its ability to reform its government and to address past crimes and abuses, especially by its military, and strengthen service delivery by the central and provincial governments. In February, I had the opportunity to visit Indonesia and met with President Yudhoyono to discuss some of these issues. I was warmly welcomed and was amazed to learn from our ambassador that I was only the second United States senator to visit there in the last 2 years. Compare that to the many, many visits that many of us have made to Iraq, understandably. And the comparison is stunning to me. I came away from my visit believing that Indonesia is on a positive trajectory. But that country can't do it alone. We can't allow the Indonesians' efforts to fail, nor can we afford to turn a blind eye to some of the problems with which they are struggling. In Papua, tensions are rising, just as they are falling in Aceh. We all know that one of the reasons they're falling in Aceh is because of the tsunami, which let people finally decide, let's try to resolve our differences there. And the military has yet to make significant progress on divesting its largely hidden and corrupt private businesses. Now, all of this matters to our national security because JI is looking for every opportunity it can find to gain a foothold in that vast country. We have to broaden our partnership with countries like Indonesia without compromising certain basic American principles. We must assist the Indonesians in their quest to build new government capabilities and services to be an effective partner in the fight against terror, but we also have to push them toward a strong rule of law, respect for human rights and accountability for past abuses, so that the Indonesians have a stake in stability and in the country's progress. To achieve success, it is critical to connect military and political assistance. I've called on the administration to create a strategy that ties together new security assistance with critical reforms in these other areas. I have yet to see one, and I'm very concerned. We are also struggling to craft a more effective approach to terrorism in Africa and places like Mali. This Muslim democracy is one of the poorest countries in the world. Northern Mali is a vast, largely ungoverned space. Includes some wonderful things. I had an opportunity to actually visit Timbuktu, if you can believe it. A fascinating, wonderful thing. But the Malian government is often incapable of projecting authority or services to the northern third of its territory. So this makes it a ripe haven for the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat, or the GSPC, a terrorist organization that uses ancient trade routes and a relatively indifferent population to harbor its training and movements. Now, who are these people? These are people, many of which, at least their forebears in the 1990s, were 3,000 people that were trained in Afghanistan with Osama bin Laden, who came back to Algeria, Algerians, who have spent many years terrorizing the people of Algeria, but they've been pushed out of there into places like Mali. So this isn't just any group. These are people that obviously buy in 100% to the philosophy and attitude that was used by those that attacked us on 9/11. The Malians I met on an official visit there last year were not most concerned about terrorism, although they were respectful, but about poverty, about trying to build a life for their children that is better than their own lives are today. That's the struggle they are engaged in. And it is in the poverty and desperation that provides an opening for terrorist ideology that terrorism can take root. The GSPC has been able to operate in northern Mali precisely because for populations there, stopping them is not a priority or maybe even a capability. And that should be of great concern to the United States. Just for the record, when I was there in last year, I was told that in this case, they were glad I'd come back because I had come there in 1999. I was the only senator that's been there in that six-year period. The only United States senator to visit that country. And think about who is exploiting it. If the U.S. doesn't make a genuine effort to help the Malian government create incentives and resources for the populations in the north to expel terrorists, the GSPC and other terrorist groups will continue to use this space and will continue to threaten U.S. and regional interests. And here's something else that should be of concern to the United States about Mali. If the United States doesn't make a genuine effort to work with the Malian government, we allow a vacuum to form that others can easily fill. Let me give you an anecdote from my trip there. When I traveled to Mali, we came back from Timbuktu and to Bamako, and they told us we had to kind of move it on our airplane, get out of the way, because somebody else was coming into the airport. And I got into a U.S. Embassy vehicle to head into the city, and looking out the car window, I saw thousands of cheering Malians were lining the streets, which had been cleared for the VIP travel. I admit, I was stunned by this outpouring of enthusiasm for this American ambassador and the less-than-household name American senator. Then I realized, wait a minute, they aren't here to cheer for us. And who was lining the streets were tens of thousands of young kids, or high school age kids. They were waiting to cheer the motorcade of then Iranian President Khatami, whose plane had just landed at the airport. I'm told that they let the kids out of school for this. Now, I don't want to be alarmist about it or exaggerate it, but I can tell you that it was a startling moment for me. And it should also be much more than that. Bamako's warm reception for the Iranian president should be a wake-up call for U.S. policymakers. Whether or not Mali was hoping to get some much-needed assistance from Iran at the time, there is no doubt that if we don't do much more to reach out to struggling countries like Mali, other influences will step in to fill the void. And those influences may not have our best interests at heart. While Mali has attracted more American interest than many of its neighbors, our diplomats still struggle to find the resources they need to compete for hearts and minds there. That short-sightedness in how we allocate our resources is costly in the long run. Somalia is a third example, and in many ways, the most alarming of all. Somalia represents to me our government's failure to adequately address failing or failed states, and it's a troubling and timely story. I'm absolutely dumbfounded and have complained repeatedly as to why our government has failed to develop a comprehensive strategy for stabilizing Somalia. Home to al-Qaeda, illicit power structures, criminal networks, abject poverty, and dire humanitarian conditions. Somalia demands far more resources and attention than we are providing. Just consider this fact. We are now spending $1.6 billion a week in Iraq, and we spend $2 million a year to support Somalia's nascent political structures. This shows how muddled our foreign policy focus has become and shows how imbalanced our approach is when it comes to fighting terrorist networks. And now just this week, there are reports of heavy fighting for control of Mogadishu. The fighting involves Islamic fundamentalists, but there are real concerns that foreign fighters may have been drawn to the conflict. Over 140 people died in Mogadishu over the last week in some of the most violent fighting the city has seen in 15 years. Meanwhile, Somalia's prime minister is pleading with the U.S. to work with the transitional government. Somalia's instability is a threat to our national security. To support a path to sustainable peace in Somalia, the administration needs to develop a comprehensive strategy for eliminating the root causes of terrorism and instability in that country. Now, that means using the whole range of political, economic, and humanitarian resources at our disposal. I have urged the administration to develop a strategy and have recently filed a resolution with Senator Coleman of Minnesota that urges the administration to appoint a special envoy to work with our partners and throughout the region to do just that. Now, I've just laid out some examples that I think illustrate some of the key challenges our country faces in three extremely important places around the world. Our governments, current single-minded, largely military-focused, and often counterproductive approach to fighting terrorism simply is not capable of meeting those challenges. So how do we begin to change that? Well, I think it starts with a return to American values and principles. If we want the United States to maintain its role in the 21st century, we have to align our principles and our national security strategy more effectively. There are at least three critical tenets of that new strategy. Strengthening international institutions and bilateral partnerships around the world, upholding and promoting respect for human rights, and helping to strengthen the rule of law globally, including especially elevating the fight against corruption. To start with the first tenet, the key to success in the fight against terrorism lies in our ability to develop and sustain strong and mutually beneficial relationships with a wide variety of partners and allies. As you all know, we have a tremendous amount of work to do in this area. President Bush's go-it-alone philosophy on everything from global warming to nuclear nonproliferation to regime change in the Middle East has made Americans less safe because it has alienated our allies and caused many to question our motives, making international consensus on addressing these issues even more difficult. Instead of acting unilaterally because we can, we should be working multilaterally because we must. Obviously, one of the most important institutions is the United Nations. For all its flaws, and they are real and serious, this institution is well situated to address some of the major security issues that we face. Yet the administration has undermined the work of the UN at almost every turn, and both parties have been weakened as a result. A recent GAO study found that UN peacekeeping is 8 times less expensive than funding a U.S. force because the UN is half as expensive and the U.S. only pays a quarter of the costs. Not only that, but this found that UN peacekeeping missions were found to be more effective than unilateral U.S. missions. Yet this administration too often acts as if we are better off going it alone. The African Union is another example. Without a U.S. ambassador to the AU and without a more robust effort to support the AU's fledgling capabilities, it will be a while before we can consider the AU an effective partner in areas such as conflict prevention, post-conflict stabilization, or military intervention. The AU's role in Darfur has been commendable, given the circumstances, but support for this institution is needed. The AU's counterterrorism center in Algiers, for example, needs support if it is going to become a center of excellence for African counterterrorism efforts. The Algerians gave it about $2 million to get started. The EU has given it solid support, and yet the United States is only prepared to support it with a small library. We have to seize this opportunity to strengthen international organizations that will serve as force multipliers or coordinating elements in this fight. And we have to link more holistically about how to support new regional and indigenous efforts to fight terrorism, instability, and corruption. Second, As we build better relationships with other nations, we must offer hope directly to people around the world by making a genuine commitment to human rights, both at home and abroad. We must demonstrate that we practice the principles we preach. Equivocating about whether torture is ever acceptable makes it more difficult for us to hold others accountable for human rights abuses. Supporting dictators like President Nguema in Equatorial Guinea, who happen to have oil resources, or President Aliyev in Azerbaijan, undermines our role as a champion of human rights and makes us complicit in a cycle of repression, corruption, and poverty. What many haven't yet realized is that this cycle has a significant impact on our national security. We must make sure that America remains a beacon of hope around the world, not a source of resentment. We must make it clear that we will no longer tolerate regimes that mouth allegiance to U.S. policies while they repress, torture, and kill their people. We must also realize that it's all too easy for terrorists to insinuate themselves into places where human rights are being violated. One of our strongest allies in Southeast Asia is facing this very problem, and we had an opportunity to explore this on this same trip when we went to Indonesia. The Muslim insurgency in southern Thailand is not yet connected to international terrorist networks, thankfully. But unless the Thai government ends its heavy-handed approach and abuse of human rights, that could change. We need to work with Thai leaders to enhance respect for human rights and to ensure that their actions do not create a situation ripe for exploitation by terrorist networks looking for new recruits. But again, we must make a genuine commitment to human rights ourselves before we can effectively encourage others and other countries to do the same. The U.S. decision to vote against the new UN Human Rights Council and its subsequent decision not to participate in that council is a perfect example of not practicing what we preach. Rather than take a role in crafting the new global human rights body, the United States was one of four countries, just four, to vote against it. The new council is far from perfect, but it is a significant improvement over the previous commission. And the administration apparently was willing to see it fail when it didn't get its way on everything. It's a clear sign that they are not willing to engage in the kind of consensus building that we need in the area of human rights in order to wage an effective fight against terrorism. Finally, human rights abuses create an atmosphere where terrorism can take root, and so do rampant corruption and the absence of the rule of law. Transparency International's Corruption Index shows us that, not surprisingly, corruption thrives in poor countries that are least capable of enforcing the rule of law. The result is a lawless environment where terrorist groups and extremist ideology can flourish. Sudan, Somalia, Kenya, Nigeria, Chad, and Angola all rank among the most corrupt countries in the world and are all home to very real threats of political instability, and in the worst cases, terrorist networks. I remember a few months before 9/11, not completely understanding what I was seeing, but being in the Islamic community of Kano, Nigeria, and seeing kids on the street selling pictures of Osama bin Laden, a country that is greatly affected by corruption. I don't need to tell you how devastating the impact of corruption has been and continues to be around the world. But a few words about why it matters to us is warranted. Simply put, those countries with the highest rates of corruption are the least able to work with us to combat terrorist threats or root out the conditions that breed extremism in their own backyard. Again, I don't want to return to the lobster boat, but let's face it. Kenya used to be the jewel of Africa, but it has now got one of the worst ratings of any country in the world on the corruption index. It is a place where corruption has been one of the greatest threats to that country and its progress. I think this clearly relates to the terrorist threat as well. People become disaffected when they see that hard work and integrity matter less than knowing the right people and being able to pay the necessary bribes. Instability and resentment undermine economic productivity, political order, and ultimately international security. In countries where corruption thrives, The U.S. must step in and offer concrete ways to stamp it out, bring stability to those societies, and restore people's faith in the rule of law. Most importantly, we have to start treating this as a component in our fight against terrorism, rather than a distraction from that central mission. To defeat the terrorists who threaten us, we must repair and strengthen our relationships with our allies and strengthen international organizations. We must ensure that American foreign and national security policies uphold true American principles, respecting human rights and the rule of law, not only because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the right strategy to strengthen our own security. Meeting the challenges we face will take an all-out effort, including our advanced military and intelligence capabilities, as well as powerful diplomatic and development efforts. We will also have to make hard decisions about when and where to engage, and we must make those decisions consciously rather than by default. A comprehensive approach will be difficult, even for the most powerful nation in the world, because we must connect with people in the farthest reaches of the most distant communities. In fact, being the most powerful nation in the world may make this approach even tougher, because we need to understand the hopes and fears of people who feel powerless and voiceless. But we are up to this challenge, and we can muster serious resources and creative diplomatic strategies to meet it head on. But to do that, we can no longer pretend that our massive presence in Iraq is serving that country, or more importantly, that is serving our own national security. It isn't. Our engagement in Iraq is weakening our ability to wage an aggressive and full-scale fight against global terrorist networks and the conditions that allow them to operate and grow. We must build a comprehensive national security strategy that seeks to bring stability and progress to people in places like Somalia, Mali, and Indonesia. Those people must believe that their communities and governments will protect them by, for example, stamping out corruption, respecting human rights, and enforcing the rule of law. Otherwise, like the fishermen in that village in Kenya, they might decide to look the other way when terrorists seek to capitalize on their disenfranchisement. Moments like those are defining moments in the fight against terrorism. We can't win this fight unless every day people in these very different places around the world want to stop terrorism as much as we do. That's the challenge we face, and that is why a comprehensive approach to fighting terrorism is our best hope to achieve our true national security mission, protecting the American people from the terrorist networks that threaten our country. Thank you, and I'll be glad to take a few questions.
Thank you, Senator. Dmitry Sidorov, Commerce and Russian Business and Political Daily. A few days ago, you said that Russia is one of the countries you have concerns about. Will you elaborate on that a little bit? Thank you.
One of the real challenges of this post-9/11 era is that there's a tendency to not only make mistakes like becoming overly focused on Iraq, but even as we talk about some of the other places I was just talking about, to forget about incredibly important countries such as Russia. Russia will be an incredibly vital aspect of our relationships in the world and our own national security. And frankly, there are serious problems with the direction of Russia in terms of protection of democratic institutions, in terms of the way that Russia is sometimes treating its neighbors through the use of energy resources or the denial of energy resources. And in order for us to have the kind of relationship with Russia that I think we all hope would happen after the Cold War, that nation and the leadership of that nation have to adhere to some basic principle that they have espoused. And I think many of us are very worried that things are moving in the wrong direction at this point. And I think it is one of our top priorities to make it clear, whether at the G8 or at other opportunities, that there is a point at which this simply doesn't work. And I think the time is now. I think the situation is getting worse rather quickly.
My name is Matteo Bosco Bortolaso from ANSA, Italian news agency. Senator, there are a couple of articles on the New York Times and Washington Post of today about the new Prime Minister of Italy that said, we consider the war in Iraq and the occupation of the country a grave error. It has not resolved but complicated the situation of security. What do you think about it?
First, I want to say that as one who voted against the Iraq war, I wanted us to succeed once we went in there, and we are deeply grateful to countries like Italy who have helped us. And that is, I think, very important to repeat, and I want to stand with the President on that. The words you just spoke are not different from what I just said. I don't use foreign countries' observations about this as my basis for coming to that conclusion, but when a country like Italy, or a leader of a country like Italy, starts saying, after they've already helped out in Iraq, that this is something that didn't work out the way we had planned, we need to listen. I think he's reflecting the fact that throughout Europe, I don't think they're feeling safer. They're probably feeling more threatened from the terrorist networks than they did prior to 9/11 for obvious reasons, whether you look at Madrid or Istanbul or London. So I respect what has been said by the leaders of Italy.
General Dutta, Foreign Policy Association. Senator, I have a very basic question, and that is most of the countries that you have cited are Muslim countries, and they are mostly poor countries, and there's a lack of education, and there's abundance of corruption, and these are the people who fall prey to the wrong interpretation of Quran. And how this education, a correct education, which could be spread out in these countries with under a major program, would be a good solution for terrorism.
Education.
Yes.
Absolutely. Well, this is without a doubt one of the most important elements. And I spoke long enough as it was, but had I had more time, I would have said something about what I've heard around the world in terms of the influence sometimes of educational influences that have come from other regions to a place like Indonesia. Now, my understanding about Islam in Indonesia is that it has been relatively moderate. In fact, I think it borrows some from some earlier Buddhist and Hindu roots that preceded Islam in Indonesia. So this is not a place where radical, extreme version of the Quran or Islam has been inherent. What I understand is that a lot of the influences come from the Middle East, people that have come there to create schools. And others have said that in modern times, people who go to pilgrimage or Hajj to in past generations, it wasn't possible for people from that far away to go and be exposed to this sort of thing. So yes, it is critical in places like Indonesia, in Pakistan, and other places in the world that there is an alternative form of Islamic education. And that is something that all of us need to try to promote so that people can have a vision of Islam that Muslims tell me is the appropriate vision of this great religion.
Tezzy Schaefer, Ambassador Schaefer. Right there, Tezzy.
Sorry, Tezzy Schaefer from CSIS.
See you.
The G8 is going to be meeting in not too long, eight countries that get together every year to talk about how they can cooperate to manage big problems in the world. What do you see as the main lines of the areas where you would like to see the G8 countries cooperate in order to fulfill your vision? I mean, what should we be trying to accomplish in this setting?
Well, obviously, first, I would like to see them cooperate in what I discussed today, which is the global effort against terrorist networks that have a ill will toward all the members of the G8. That means trying to work together to promote the institutions I talked about, to use their good offices and their bilateral, multilateral relationships to require elimination of corruption and the standing up for human rights. At the same time, I want to see G8 continue to deal with horrible problems in the world, such as pandemics, whether it be the HIV/AIDS problem that I have spent a great deal of time on, or the possibility of the avian flu problem. Those countries, with the wealth that they have got to signal to the rest of the world a seriousness about that and continue to lead the world on it. Clearly, these countries have to do as much as they can, working together as a group, to encourage countries like North Korea and Iran to drop their nuclear intentions. When they asked John Kerry and George Bush what was the biggest threat to the world, I probably would have said terrorist networks, but they made a perfectly good answer. They said nuclear proliferation and nuclear threats. Really, nothing can be more important that these countries signal to the world that they intend to take the lead on trying to resolve those problems. So those are some of the matters, but again, I see these countries as having an opportunity, and the United States has to take the opportunity to work with them to deal with this terrorist threat.
Thank you. Question right back here.
Christoph von Marschall, I'm the U.S. correspondent of the German daily Der Tagesspiegel. I would like to come to the problem, the conflict around Iran's nuclear program. How can we adopt your ideas about building better relationships, better alliances with your allies to solve those problems? Some of your European allies, also my country, would like to see the United States to enter direct talks with Iran about the nuclear program for two reasons. One of all, only the United States can deliver what Iran is asking for, international acknowledgement and security guarantees. And second, even if those talks fail, it might persuade China and Russia that it's not the fault of the United States that we can't come to an agreement, but Iran's fault, and that would improve the chances, opportunities to get sanctions against Iran. How do you stand on this? Direct talks with Iran on the nuclear issue.
First, let me say that, and this is a difficult thing to say the way I want, but I want to be clear. When the president says that he doesn't take any option off the table, I think that's what a president should say. In other words, you don't literally say that we would ever do anything to prevent ourselves from being able to defend ourselves as a matter of self-defense. But that shouldn't be the emphasis in our talks and in our efforts. Nor am I overwhelmed by the diatribe that the president of Iran sent to the president. I think what was said is not significant or meaningful. The fact that he sent a letter, interesting. Having said all that, I think it is time for us to start thinking seriously, and many people are calling for this, for some kind of direct talks in a multilateral setting in combination with a sanctions approach. In other words, I don't think it's an either or. I think to not have either the reality or the possibility of sanctions as a part of these multilateral talks would be a mistake and give Iran too great of a free pass. But I am going to say that it is time for us to seriously think about a multilateral approach to direct talks that we would try to participate in. And I would be eager to see the administration consider that.
Thank you. We have a question right here in the middle.
Thank you. John Bradshaw, Freedom Investment Project. Senator, I was struck as you laid out your vision for strengthening institutions, upholding human rights and the rule of law, and fighting corruption, that you did not discuss the idea of democracy promotion. And I wondered if you could lay out for us how you see the peaceful support for democratic transitions and democratic oppositions as fitting into your vision.
Well, of course, not only would I have spent a fair amount of time on it had I had time, it is obviously critical. You know, I think this is one that we understand a little better than some of the others. This is one that, of course, if things had gone better in Iraq at this point, maybe they still will, that could be helpful there, but I certainly believe that the promotion of democracy is critical to making sure that people don't feel disenfranchised, obviously. I mean, you could take examples such as Tanzania, where the election disputes in Zanzibar, where there are concerns that democracy isn't being respected there, that there are problems with the vote. You might say, well, why is he talking about Zanzibar? Well, it's in the same region. It's basically 100% Islamic area. But there are serious tensions within that area, and there are, I believe, potentially foreign, potential terrorist influences that can exploit a situation where people think that their democratic rights have been frustrated. So, of course, this is part of the strategy, and I would list it very high.
Markus Zina, the German Business Daily Handelsblatt. Senator, you've just been asking very clearly about withdrawal of the American troops from Iraq. I wonder now to what extent this is conventional wisdom within your party, and if so, to what extent this is going to be addressed in the upcoming midterm elections. Thank you.
Well, I certainly don't dare to speak for my party on its conventional wisdom. You got the wrong guy for that. But, you know, I think that most people, in fact, I think most Americans now, apart from the Democratic Party, really do understand that having this force on the ground there is counterproductive, and that we're not solving the problem simply by having our troops in danger. We did have 40 senators, including, I think, 39 Democrats, maybe it was 38, vote for a timetable concept back in October. I fear that this has slipped a little bit, which puzzles me, because the people on Fox News aren't even saying they're for the war anymore, basically. I mean, nobody really thinks this is working out the way we intended, and people are looking for an answer to how to get our troops out. So I think that it is really an American consensus, and it's just time for Washington to catch up, regardless of what party is involved.
Thank you. Mahmoud Hamadawi with Al Jazeera's Washington Bureau. You talked a lot about the role of the UN and that we are failing in because of Guantanamo, as you said it. In light of this recent report by the UN of the importance of closing not only Guantanamo Bay, but all U.S. secret prisons, what can you say is the role that torture plays in foreign policy, as well as what your feelings on of keeping Guantanamo Bay opened?
Well, I don't think torture, and I'm not saying where torture occurs or where it doesn't occur, but I will say this, that torture should have no role in our foreign policy. We made an effort in the Senate to make it clear that we believe that, and I have tried on every occasion, whether asking questions of the current Attorney General or even with General Hayden and others, to make it clear that that the administration respects the fact that that is not American policy and should not be American policy. I think that many of those in the international community that are calling for us to move away from having Guantanamo are on the right track. It is costing us so much in public relations, as well as the feelings that people have about what may or may not be going on there, that I think we have to at least consider the possibility of doing something else. It may not be in our interests, as well as involving some very serious questions.
Good afternoon, Senator. Dan Riley from the Milwaukee Journal. Speaking of General Hayden, certainly the director of the CIA is a key part of our nation's national security strategy. Can you comment on how the confirmation progress is progressing, specifically how he's done in addressing questions about whether or not he misled Congress with respect to wiretapping? And finally, can you give us any indication how you may vote on this nomination?
Well, you know, I had concerns going in, not about General Hayden, the professional, or General Hayden, the human being. I mean, I am impressed with him. I'm impressed with his record. He's enormously capable. I also find him easy to talk to and often forthcoming. There is a greater problem here, though, and I was candid with the general about this both in private and in public, and that is that he, along with the president and others, were the architects of a wiretapping, illegal wiretapping program that I think flies in the face of the Constitution. To be asked to vote for somebody who does not pull back from that, who continues, as he did yesterday under my questioning, to say that Article 2 of the Constitution, under the Commander-in-Chief powers, allows him to do this regardless of the FISA statute and clear law, is deeply troubling. And as I pressed him, I said, you know, this is your answer can't be that I follow the law unless the president tells me not to. I think he has an independent obligation to follow the law as a person that would be confirmed by the United States Senate. Now, he may sincerely believe that Article 2 of the Constitution can override any act of Congress. I think that's wrong. I think that changes our system of government. And unless he is able to withdraw from that extreme notion without any personal animus whatsoever, it would be very difficult for me to vote for him. Thanks so much, everybody.